Hello, I'm Steve Punce.
And I'm Hugh Dennis.
With us are Kay Curd, Flo and Joan, George Fouracres and Lucy Porter. And this is...
The Noel Show!
Thank you very much and welcome to the Now Show souvenir pull-out special to celebrate two pieces of good news. One, Prince Harry is to marry Meghan Markle next May. And two, the plan is to put the TV coverage on pay-per-view and sort the Brexit divorce bill in a single morning.
Yep, a billion viewers worldwide, 50 quid each, and we are there. And that doesn't take into account the boost to the economy that comes from a royal wedding, what with all that merchandising. Within hours of the engagement, Royal Dalton had announced they were releasing an exclusive hand-painted ceramic box set of Season 5 of Suits.
Yes. Very nice. And congratulations poured in from all over the world. North Korea even set off a rocket.
Everyone got very excited that one half of the couple is mixed race.
Yes, and isn't it great to see someone of Anglo-German-Greek heritage marrying an American? In any case, to the British aristocracy, mixed race means anyone who isn't actually a first cousin. So it's not really that big a deal.
Although a few die-hard traditionalists claimed that Markle was an unsuitable bride because she'd been through a divorce, just like Prince Charles and Camilla and Princess Anne and Prince Andrew. And by the end of March 2019, the entire country. So, in a way, she could only be more British if she'd walked into a door and immediately apologised to it.
Although it has to be said that one world leader stood out by very noticeably not tweeting any congratulations.
Buckingham Palace called to offer me the position of best man, but said it would entail a photo shoot and an interview, so I took a pass.
Trump claimed recently that Time magazine had offered him Man of the Year, although the magazine themselves denied they ever ask anyone in advance, and that in any case, they had offered Man of the Year to Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Yes. The year in question being 1835. Anyway, President Trump will probably not be invited, mainly because he has strict requirements for attending and the couple don't want to be married in the middle of a golf course.
He's far too busy retweeting fake footage from racist hate groups. Jeremy Corbyn said that Trump's Britain First tweets this week were...
a threat to our society.
Which must be a bit confusing for him, since according to most of our national newspapers, threatening our society is Jeremy Corbyn's job. To make matters worse for Trump, Meghan is apparently friendly with the Obamas, so it's fairly likely that they will be invited.
Yes, and Barack Obama may even be asked to read at the ceremony, reminding us all of the days when US presidents could be asked to read.
For all the modern trappings, though, ultimately a royal wedding will always follow traditional protocol. On her marriage, Meghan Markle is expected to be given the title of Duchess of Sussex.
Yes, and as a consequence, somewhere in Brighton, a popular drag act is having to order new stationery. Actually, a few dukedoms available. Connaught and Clarence. And there are a few other places he could be Duke of, which may suit Harry and his American wife better.
Hazard. Ellington and Earl. It's also going to be a busy few months for royal experts, of course, who will, as ever, be there to give us the benefit of their wisdom.
And she gets out of the coach now, and yes, I can confirm she's wearing a dress. Over to a woman in a hat now to describe a dress we can all see anyway.
Well, this is very exciting. I can see straight away that not only is she wearing a dress, but also she's wearing shoes. Very much as experts predicted, and in what will surely be seen as a nod to her mother-in-law, the late Princess Diana, who also famously wore shoes.
Well, thank you. And now this is a very exciting moment as Meghan Markle's sister has arrived and media experts crane forward for a good perv over her arse.
Now, of course, not everyone was happy about the announcement, and very quickly there were conspiracy theories circulating online with people going...
I wonder what bad news the government's covering up.
How can they be covering up bad news? It's everywhere! The idea that the royals time events to suit the government is nonsense, but it probably derives from the fact that royal weddings do often seem to happen at moments of national gloom and doom. The Queen was married at the height of post-war austerity and rationing in 1947.
And Princess Elizabeth skips from the royal coach and enters the Abbey as the crowd in their best suits and hats shout their happy cries of hurrah for the royal couple.
Princess Anne married at the height of the three-day week, strikes and economic turmoil in 1973.
And Princess Anne steps from her Austin Allegro and enters the Abbey as the crowd, in their best cheesecloth shirts and slacks, shout their happy cries of, "Ooh, Betty, the cat's done a whoopsie in my bare air."
Charles and Diana married in 1981 in a summer of riots, unemployment and unrest.
Princess Diana steps from the royal coach and enters the cathedral as the crowd, in their best leg warmers, shout their happy cries of Maggie, 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 out, out, out.
Now, what was particularly great was that the day after Harry and Meghan's announcement, the news basically went like this. First item...
New government figures show that the UK's productivity is the worst in the G7, below even that of Italy, let alone Germany, France, Canada and the US.
The next item...
The public are demanding a day off for the royal wedding.
You see, it's brilliant. We are officially less productive than countries where they take a two-hour carb-based lunch followed by a nap. And we're fed up that we don't get a day off to watch the telly. Our lack of productivity is one of the reasons why the government is so keen to get a deal with the EU, which came a step closer this week as the government upped their offer on the divorce bill to somewhere between 40 and 50 billion euros, although they'd happily go higher if Brussels keeps custody of Nigel Farage.
The format of the negotiations is fairly clear now. Britain asks for things that aren't possible, and the EU says no. It might get a bit boring were it not for the handy fact that they have at least 27 different ways of saying it.
We want access to the single market.
No.
But without free movement of people.
Nein.
Free movement of goods.
Nee.
But inside the customs union.
Nope.
Passport in rights for banks.
No.
No ECJ rulings.
Nee.
Frictionless borders.
Nee.
Can we get it all free?
Nah.
If we pay you this 45 billion, do we get nectar points?
No, 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 no.
I've got five more questions.
Then let me answer them all in a way you British may understand. Nay, nay, and thrice times nay.
And now, a comedian passionate about making politics accessible to young people, which clearly is why he's on Radio 4. Would you please welcome Kay Kurd?
Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. It's actually my first time here at the Now Show, and it's great to be in front of such a diverse audience of middle-class people. I want to talk about social media because, like any millennial, I'm addicted to social media and it's a big part of my life. These past few weeks, however, have highlighted some of the stuff that makes me uncomfortable with regards to using it. But where do I even start? Ollie Murs of X Factor fame being trolled by the public for live tweeting the events in Oxford Circus last Friday. Journalists are digging up past tweets from celebrities such as YouTuber Jack Maynard, who was in the I'm a Celebrity jungle, to grime artist Stormzy, ranging from racism to homophobia. You know, the sort of stuff that's referred to in Russia as normal life. It wasn't all like that, though. Some of the stuff that was brought to light was downright hilarious and contradictory. Like this one in 2012 from Amir Khan, who's also a contestant on this year's I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, as part of a Twitter Q&A.
Would you ever go on I'm a Celebrity? Hashtag Ask Amir.
Noise for has-beens.
This tweet has since been deleted. But to be fair to Amir Khan, he wasn't a has-been in 2012. This subject, however, brings up the question, how far are we going to judge people for what they've said on social media? Sometimes as teenagers or kids. I think we've all tweeted and said some stuff in our past that we're embarrassed about. I went through my Twitter and I can't believe how cringy it all was. Like this one from the 24th of November, 2012.
Made in Chelsea is basically the Conservative Party conference with Instagram filters.
Now, Facebook has a feature called On This Day, and it brings up everything you've posted from that day in past years. And it's great to see what you're up to on this day in the past, or in my case, it reminds me on a daily basis how much I hate the past me. Not only does it remind me that I went on a lad's holiday to Malia, it also reminds me that I went dressed in espadrilles, three-quarter lengths, and a burgundy T-shirt that had diamantes on it. I thought I looked cool. But instead, I looked like an Enreg Ford Fiesta that had been blinged up on Pimp My Ride. Now, if someone wants to read out my Facebook memories from 2007 to 2010, they'd see I'm a pompous, arrogant git. And now, thankfully, I'm not pompous at all. Now, no one can see my Facebook memories, though, but it does make me think it is probably the hardest time in history to be famous, especially as a young person when all your thoughts and streams of consciousness have been recorded on these online platforms for the world to see and accessible to them at any given time. I'm sure a lot of our beloved figures from the past, be it actors or musicians, said stuff that we don't agree with. The only difference is the Beatles didn't have a stenographer following them around noting everything they said.
Hey, John, let's go find some birds.
June 1965, Ringo refers to women as animals of a winged nature and sexualizes them.
Nobody becomes the finished article straight away. Do you think Plato came up with the allegory of the caves at 17 and was able to explain it in 140 characters? We also saw the effects of social media in light of the events at Oxford Circus. Thankfully, it was a false alarm and nothing happened, but I was actually there caught up in the madness, and we were told to get out by the police. But it's easy for people who weren't there to belittle the matter, but it was genuinely a horrific experience. I mean, you try being locked up in a department store for 2 hours with Olly Murs. Jokes aside, his tweets weren't helpful. Here's what he genuinely tweeted.
Everyone get out of Selfridges now. Gunshots, I'm inside.
When you mention gunshots at a time of mass confusion and widespread hysteria and the presence of police vans and fire engines, it does put people on edge and create a heightened sense of fear. I get it. He probably felt scared too. However, in the midst of all of this, he still had time to find the official Selfridges Twitter account, tag them in a tweet, and then send it, as if he was giving them a Black Friday special on social media advertising. I get why he tweeted it, though. You know, he was scared and he needed to tell people, because let me tell you, those stampedes were no joke. I haven't seen anything like that since Mufasa died in The Lion King. Now, I always thought I'd deal with something like that much better than I did, because I come from a family of very strong men. I came to the UK as a refugee when I was 6 months old. My family fleeing from the Kurdish region of Iraq as my parents were part of the armed resistance fighting against Saddam Hussein. My father and uncles were involved in the armed struggle. They've been in battles. They've seen war, blood and bullets. It's not the narrative that certain media outlets try to portray of refugees being opportunistic chances. You know, there's nobody leaving their country in 40 degree heat because they like the idea of Nando's and a Wetherspoons. No, nobody's coming here going, I wonder what all bar one is like. Now, in fact, my dad was such a hard man to rebel against when I was younger. When I'd misbehave, he'd ask me, you think you're special? You think you're special? I can get rid of you and make another one tomorrow. Shut up. But in the back of my mind, I always thought that level of bravery my father and my uncles possessed and that hard nature would just be passed down via genetics. In reality, it was actually like a scene from The Lion King, and I was Simba running from the crowd, and Olly Murs was my Zazu flapping about.
Everyone get out of Selfridges now! Gunshots, I'm inside!
Thank you very much.
So now, welcome to the stage, fresh from watching the Harry and Meghan interview on loop for the last 72 hours, Lucy Porter.
Yes, this royal wedding has really turned things on its head. Because Harry is marrying an American divorced mixed-race actress, some people just cannot cope. The usually pro-royalty Daily Mail and Spectator are furious about the nuptials, while the usually Republican Guardian couldn't be happier. I hear even the editor of Marxism Today is cock-a-hoop and buying a new hat. The Spectator described Meghan as a glossy actress, clearly signalling that if Harry must marry an actress, at least make it one with a matte finish. I think this marriage is evidence of the royal family modernising in the only way the royal family can, incredibly and painfully slowly. But even though I'm ambivalent about the royals, I do love a royal wedding because I love memorabilia. Because it makes us normal folk feel like we've been a part of the big day. Honestly, scraping dried cat food off Will and Kate's faces as they beam up at me from my souvenir plate takes me right back to Westminster Abbey. My husband and I have Charles and Di tea trays, Andrew and Fergie mugs, Princess Margaret and Lord Snowden tea towels. It serves to remind us that one day you're young, in love and getting married, and that next you're divorced and being used to mop up Ribena. My My collection just seems to keep growing. It all began with a commemorative thimble. But let me tell you now, people, thimbles really are the gateway to that dark and slippery collectibles slope. Before I knew it, I was checking eBay for Charles and Diana egg cups and novelty money boxes. I even started buying the Daily Express. I barely recognised myself. Still, now I have got all this stuff, I thought I should find out, is it worth anything? So I asked this lovely lady.
I'm Catherine Southern. I'm an expert on antiques programmes and I run my own auction house.
So I talked to Catherine about my immense collection. I've got a Charles and Di, it's a spoon, it's like a teaspoon, and I don't want to get you too excited, Catherine, but it is silver plated. Yes, I was looking forward to selling my spoon and retiring to the islands, but Catherine had some news for me.
I think it's going to be about £1 or £2.
£1 or £2. Still, I was still confident. I asked you about my very fine Charles and Diana sugar tin.
I think the important thing is to keep things like this in really good condition. If you've got it, I mean, you said it's a little bit battered on the side. Keep it in good condition.
It's a bit battered. It's half his face is gone, if we're honest, half his face. I scratched it off when he married Camilla. She must never be queen. Anyway, I also asked Catherine about my bottle of Charles and Diana commemorative beer brewed by Indcoop in 1981 and still unopened. I wanted to know, should I drink it?
Keep it. Keep it.
Okay. Oh, good.
Don't even think about drinking it.
Is that because it's going to be worth a lot of money or because it will send me blind if I do drink it?
Both.
Catherine did have some encouraging words.
I'm really impressed by your collection because I think, okay, it might not be worth a lot of money, but you've got a lot of joy out of it.
Joy? Bloody joy. Does John Humphreys get out of bed in the morning for joy? So Catherine did tell me that my mass-produced items are worthless, but she said that personal effects are where the money is. But how do you get hold of the royals' personal things? I suppose I could get a job at the palace and slowly work my way into their confidence in the full knowledge I'll eventually be able to auction off a load of stuff, a technique commonly known as burrowing. Well, if I can't go for quality, I'll go for quantity of memorabilia. So I decided to get some tips from a lady who really knows her stuff.
My name is Margaret Tyler, and I've got approximately 10,000 items of royal memorabilia.
Wow. So naturally, my first question was, where does she keep it all?
I've got four rooms plus a large bedroom, and they're all full.
So Margaret said it's good to group your collection by couple. So I'm going to have to allocate certain rooms of my house to certain royals. Wills and Kate can have the kitchen. Meghan and Harry can have the spare room. And the attic conversion can be left clear for when Princess Eugenie marries Stormzy. I asked Margaret if there was any limit to what she'd collect. Would she draw the line anywhere? Surely even she would refuse to buy a royal wedding toilet brush.
Yes, I think I would. Yes, yes. And also there were condoms on sale with William and Kate's photo on. There's no way I would have bought those.
No, if you're going to use a member of the royal family for contraception, it's Edward, isn't it? Let's be honest. So despite her high standards, Margaret has got some less well-loved items. She described to me the worst thing in her collection.
I gave it a home because I thought, it's so ugly, nobody's going to buy it. I'll give it a home. Charles and Diana are on it. I mean, it was for their wedding, and they actually look like the Everly brothers. They don't look like anything like them.
And they lost that loving feeling, didn't they? I asked, what do you think is the best thing about collecting memorabilia?
You might find something that's quite grubby or doesn't look all that, but you take it home and wash it and it looks nice and you feel really pleased with yourself that you've saved it.
Like my husband. Long may Margaret continue collecting her memorabilia, and I can't wait to see what the new royal wedding will bring for my collection. I was thinking, because Harry is obviously British and Meghan's American, how about some kind of souvenir, bilateral, mutually beneficial trade agreement between the US and the UK? That might be fun.
So, as we come closer to agreeing a divorce bill and what will happen to the Irish border, the Brexit negotiations seem to be heading to the next stage. But how do the negotiations actually work? Who talks to who? Who's advising who? Who's shouting agitated from the sidelines?
Well, here to share his expertise on the subject, would you please welcome the author of All Out War and new book Fallout, the inside story of the last election, the political editor of the Sunday Times, Tim Shipman.
Tim, we all know the sort of main ideological battlegrounds of Brexit, so the single market, free movement, control of borders, etc. But who have been the key personalities shaping the course of Brexit so far?
Well, a couple of people called Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill, who sort of helped shape what the Prime Minister got up to when she first took power. Unfortunately, they made a horlicks of the general election and they've now had to depart. So it's just Theresa May sitting in a room on her own.
While all this was going on, what was the attitude of the civil service?
They were a little bit frightened and a little bit bewildered. Initially, they were all worried about getting the sack, and then quite a few of them were sort of forced to leave, who expressed concerns. There was a chap called Ivan Rogers, who was our ambassador to the European Union, and he said, well, you know, these Europeans will all stick together and they'll demand loads of money and you won't get a deal in 2 years and you'll need a transition period and it will all be terrible and you certainly shouldn't trigger Article 50 by the end of March because you'll need much more time than that, and the second you trigger it, they'll have you over a barrel. And all the people around Theresa May said, no, don't be ridiculous, that's far too negative. And here we are a year later and Ivan Rogers is looking a little bit cleverer than he was a year ago.
And do you think now, after all this sort of infighting and internal stuff going on in the cabinet, we are now negotiating with one voice?
I think no is the short answer to that question. I think it was Mr. Frankie Boyle who said, the great thing is we're doing Brexit by the book. The only problem is that the book is Lord of the Flies. I mean, I phone up cabinet ministers every week and try and find out who's arguing with who, and it's not often that difficult to find out what's been going on. So you've got sort of Boris Johnson and Michael Gove on one side, and then Philip Hammond on the other, who's sort of in the role of Piggy, who is the whipping boy of the Brexiteers. So with one voice, no, not quite. And the problem is we're up against people who spend their entire time negotiating.
So that is the question, isn't it? It seemed to me that we made the mistake early on of thinking that we were just going to tell them EU what we wanted and that would all be fine. Well, and we kind of forgot that we were in a negotiation.
Well, it's all very logical what we want here. It's very logical, and if only they could see the logic of it, it would be great. But unfortunately, they forgot the words of that great philosopher, Mr. Mike Tyson, who said, everyone's got a plan until you punch them in the mouth. So we turned up with our plan, and then we got punched in the mouth. And that's basically the story of the last year.
So who then are we negotiating with? Who's on the other side?
You know, Michel Barnier, who's this very smooth Frenchman, is the sort of point man, but he's only allowed to do certain things. He's only allowed to negotiate within the parameters of his negotiation. Whereas back home, you know, Theresa May has never written down what we're actually planning to do, which allows every single one of her ministers to take to the airwaves and provide their own interpretation of it.
Do you think Barnier respects David Davis? How do they get on?
Well, they sort of... They've actually known each other for years. They were both Europe ministers together years ago, but they're sort of like chalk and cheese, you know. DD is this sort of ex-SAS man who has the sort of nose of a boxer who's rather more enthusiastic than he is talented. and Michel Barnier is this sort of really smooth French guy, probably uses a bit too much hair oil. And Didi is sort of inherently a bit suspicious of the French. I once asked him who he wanted to be the next French president, and he thought about it for a little while and said, well, it probably doesn't matter because they're all bloody French.
And what about Labour? I mean, is Corbyn really as anti-EU as he appears?
Well, there's two things here. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn, back in the 1990s, was counted by Bill Cash and all the big Eurosceptics as a member of their gang on all the votes on Maastricht. And Jeremy Corbyn hasn't really changed his mind on anything in 40 years, so we shouldn't probably have expected him to change it on this. But what he's been quite clever at is allowing the other people in his party, Keir Starmer, his Brexit spokesman in particular, to acknowledge the fact that quite a lot of Labour voters would like to see a softer Brexit.
Can I ask you about Boris? Because in your new book, you quote someone as saying that Boris knows he'll be drummed out of the country if it goes wrong. Has he really lashed himself to the Brexit mast in that way?
Yeah, I think he has. I mean, you know, as we know, things were a little bit ambiguous when Boris decided to back Brexit. And in my first book, we printed both Boris's Remain and Leave articles, which he wrote 2 days before his declaration. He got in touch with me afterwards and said, dear Tim, well done, F off. Now, I'm fairly sure that stands for Foreign Office, but I can't... But since then, you know, Boris, the humour hasn't travelled. We might sit there and say, oh, it's terribly clever when he said to the Italians, we're not anti-pasto, we are pro-secco. But that works OK in English. It didn't travel very well.
Thank you very much indeed. Tim Chipman. So please now welcome to the stage for a seasonal sing-song. And it is now December, you cannot complain. Please welcome to the Now Show, Flo and Joan.
Yeah, it's December and Advent has started. The YouTube celebrity Zoella has brought out a calendar this year which costs £50, which is insane. And also it's not even a real Advent calendar because it only has 12 doors on it. And we think this is obviously a huge waste of your money. So for anyone considering buying one of these Advent calendars, we have some suggestions of other ways you can spend your £50 instead. You could buy 66 loaves of bread. You could buy 22 frappuccinos, or 125 pints of milk, or 6.5 half chickens from Nando's. Yes, that's 3.5 whole chickens. You could buy 3,000 Tetley tea bags, or a £12 Christmas turkey. Or you could invest your £50. At this rate, you can turn it into £9 by 2030. And I'd still rather that than buy your calendar. You could buy 8 pints of beer if you live in London, or 17.8 if you live in Hull. You could buy a sip of a drink on an aeroplane, or a tenth of a ticket on a Southwest train. Or you could take 2 bags on an easy jet flight. You don't go with them, but your bags get a holiday. Have fun in Spain, bags. We know what you're thinking. £50, that's a lot of money. But 50 for an Advent calendar. Ha ha, Zoella. Very greedy and irresponsible. You could buy a wicker chair, or a set of mugs, or brand new hair, or a lovely jug. You could buy 2 very nice bottles of wine. Then drunk order the calendar online. And when it arrives and you are sober, you can return it for a refund. That way, Zoella has to give you money. You could buy 50 packs of 2-pack flannels, buy a fancy light and set up your own YouTube channel, and sell your own calendar for $49.99, and make sure it's got 24 doors this time, or you could send 60 letters to Zoella saying that you're not fooling us with your Christmas tat. Hey!
Thank you for listening, and goodbye!
Goodbye! You've been listening to The Now Show, starring Steve Punch, Hugh Dennis, Lucy Porter, Kay Kurt, Flo and Joan, George Fouracres and Tim Chipman. It was written by the cast with additional material from Jenny LaVille, John Hunter, Laura Major and Alice Gray. The producer was Adnan Ahmed. It was a BBC Studios production.